House Committee of Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, May 9th, 2017, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 368. Senator Hansel, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 368 prohibits private insurance companies from denying coverage or canceling a policy solely because the insured is in detention pending adjudication. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Barker. A member of the committee, and for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29, which is North Central and Eastern Oregon. Last July, I received an email from Dale Primer, the director of Umatilla County Community Corrections Program, and Umatilla County Commissioner Bill Elfring regarding an issue in Umatilla County. In June of 2015, a juvenile was involved in a shooting. The youth was a shooter, and he himself was shot in the arm. The bullet did significant damage to his arm, which advanced to the point where extensive medical procedures were needed. The juvenile had been remanded to custody by the court, and as such, his insurance was discontinued once placed in detention. In 2014 session, you may recall, we passed House Bill 4110 at the request of Claudia Black of Multnomah County. HB 4110 stated that an insured individual who is in custody of a local supervisory authority is allowed to keep their insurance as long as they paid their premiums. That bill required the insurer to reimburse the county for covered services. The bill, however, was only for individuals over the age of 18. Because of this, youths who are in the correction system in counties where detention facilities are located are the responsibility of the county for all medical costs until they turn 18 years of age. In the case of the juvenile I referenced to in Umatilla County, that was 5 months. But it could be years if juveniles are placed in corrections at an earlier age. As mentioned before, HB 4140, we allowed insurance policies to continue when their client was pretrial incarcerated. To that extent, Senate Bill 368 does the same for pretrial incarcerated juveniles. It passed out of the Senate Judiciary unanimously and off the Senate floor unanimously. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions for Senator Hansen?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment. This is when we keep it, this is sort of whack-a-mole. Every time we hit it, it pops up in some other place. There's no reason why this should not happen. The fact that we have to keep passing statutes is ridiculous, and thank you for bringing this one.
Chair Barker, Representative Grant, I agree. I mean, we think we have it covered, and then something happens. In this case, my home county, and it wasn't covered, so we back with new legislation.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Thank you. Close the public hearing, open the work session on Senate Bill 368.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 368 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 368 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Yes.
We'll be happy to carry that, Mr. Chair.
I think, Representative Lanier, did you want to carry 368? Was that the one you requested?
Yes, please.
Yeah, she's asked for it. So, Representative Lanier will be the carrier. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 762A. Call Senator Taylor.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 762A provides that no minor victim of a sexual assault may be arrested or prosecuted for purchasing or possessing alcohol because of evidence obtained during the investigation if any person reports a crime to or seeks assistance from emergency medical services or law enforcement. Senate Bill 762A also extends immunity to those who seek assistance on behalf of someone else. There is a minimal expenditure impact, no revenue impact, and no amendments.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21. I'm very happy to share my support for Senate Bill 762 with the committee, and I'm so pleased to be here with Senator Gelser. If we as a body share the common goal of wanting to end sexual assault and hold perpetrators accountable, we must work to find ways to remove barriers to reporting those crimes. Experts know alcohol to be the most common drug used when perpetrating sexual assault, and no matter your state of sobriety or inebriation, being assaulted is never deserved or okay. It is important that we make sure survivors know that if they report their assault, they will not inadvertently find themselves in trouble for having consumed or been in possession of alcohol. This will help to ensure young people come forward and report their crimes and access medical care and support systems. Additionally, our criminal justice system is more likely to have an opportunity to hold perpetrators accountable. And I want to just go ahead and thank Senator Gelser again and urge your support for the bill, please.
And thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, and I had so much fun spending the whole day here with you on Thursday that I wanted to come back. I'm very pleased to be here with Senator Taylor. Senate Bill 762 is particularly important for young people. As Senator Taylor said, we know that when alcohol is present, it can increase the likelihood or risk of sexual assault, but that is never the fault of the victim of that assault. By focusing only on getting the assistance to the victim that is needed, we are focusing on what's most important. I believe Senator Thatcher on the floor talked about we are prioritizing these services, which becomes the most important issue at the time that a crime is being committed. What this bill will allow is both for the victim to be able to receive services without fear of being charged with a minor in possession. It also will allow a bystander to be able to report that assault, which means the opportunity to stop an assault in process without fear of being prosecuted for a minor in possession. This is incredibly important, especially in our college campuses, and I hope that you will support it.
Thank you. Any questions of the senators? Thank you, senators. Caller Mar Wise, Tabitha Fitzer, and Jacqueline Logsdon.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Lamar Wise. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. I just wanted to give some brief background before I pass it off to our wonderful students here. First off, sexual assault is a huge issue on college campuses. Each year we do, or every 2 years we do a statewide survey where we survey about 10% of our member campuses, and sexual assault and issues dealing with sexual assault marked top three on just about all of our campuses. And so dealing with this, we pursued this policy, which is survivor amnesty. And we're doing this to, again, ensure that we are knocking down barriers to reporting for students and anyone who may have been under the influence while they have been assaulted. And so I'm just here to give an organizational perspective, but again, I think you all should hear from our students firsthand, and they've all done great work on this as well.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, and Olson. My name is Tabitha Pitzer, and I'm a third-year student at Oregon State University. I'm here before you today to urge you to support Senate Bill 762 and survivors of sexual assault across the state. According to the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted during their first 2 years in college, and I am one of them. My freshman year at Oregon State, at the age of 19, I was sexually assaulted in the basement of a fraternity by an upperclassman. Like many others, I was attending a party and was given alcohol. I didn't notice that the drinks were being given to me more frequently and stronger, but I trusted my friend that was giving me the drinks. I trusted him to ensure my safety, but he was the one who hurt me the most. After the sexual assault, I was confused. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. I'm thinking to myself, do I report? Will they believe me even though I've been drinking? Will I get an MIP? In the end, I chose not to report or seek help for fear of facing legal trouble myself. 90% of campus sexual assaults go unreported, and mine is one of them. Considering that approximately half of all sexual assault survivors report that they were drinking alcohol at the time of the assault, I know that I'm not the only underage person who has not reported a sexual assault, most likely due to fear of getting in trouble while seeking help. We need policies to ensure that survivors know that the state cares most about our safety and not about what we have been consuming. Legislation that puts the survivor first with legal amnesty will increase reporting rates and increase accurate and honest reporting. Forward-thinking legislation like this emphasizes the stories of survivors, which is why the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force supports this bill. Alcohol is the most common date rape drug, often used by predators as a tool, like it was in my case. Just as those sexually assaulted under the influence of roofies would not be prosecuted for consuming an illegal substance, those who consume alcohol underage and seek help should have the same protection. Please support Senate Bill 762 to show survivors, like me, that you care most about our safety. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, other members of the committee. My name is Jacqueline Logsdon. I'm a fourth-year student at Oregon State University studying environmental economics and policy, and I'm the Assistant Director of Government Relations with ASOSU. I'm one of the 1 in 5 women who will be sexually assaulted in college. I'm one of the 50% that was under the influence of alcohol. I was assaulted during my first 4 terms of college when I was 18 years old, and I'm one of the 90% who didn't report their case. My freshman year of college, I was a coxswain on the men's rowing team, and I was raped at the end of my freshman year by one of my teammates. It was an end-of-the-year party. I was around the people who were supposed to be there for me, to support me, the people who I really built a family around my freshman year. And so when I ended that night, the last thing I remember was falling asleep next to a toilet in a dirty bathroom, and yet I woke up in an unfamiliar bed with a teammate who was supposed to be just that, a teammate. I was really confused. So I told one person the morning after and kind of left it at that. I didn't fully process what had occurred. It wasn't until the beginning of my sophomore year, I took the Haven module, and I read the 1 in 5 statistic when I had that sinking realization that that was me. I was the 1 in 5, and that sucked. I didn't tell my mom, my own mother, about my assault until a year afterwards. I had a flashback when I went back into the room that I was raped in. I was going to get a phone charger, and a new person was in that room, and yet I walked in and I saw the whole room exactly the way that it was. And even after telling my mother all of this, she still told me that it was my fault what happened. Being assaulted is a really isolating incident. You know, we know that this happens on college campuses. We know that this is a pervasive issue, and yet you feel so alone. And I know family members that have been assaulted. I have friends that have been assaulted, and yet it's so taboo for us to even speak about it. I never reported what happened to me. I was scared to come forward. I was scared that maybe I wanted it. I was scared that because I was under the influence of alcohol that it was my fault. I still to this day have to be careful when I drink, because I'll bring it up and I'll cry about it and I'll scare the people that are around me. I lost most of my sophomore year of college because I was trying to process an event that I didn't realize that I couldn't do alone. Senate Bill 762 grants survivors their protection and security to come forward with their case, which was something that I personally was too scared to do. There are already so many social barriers in place stopping survivors from reporting. And if legislators really want to begin having these conversations and finding solutions to a major problem on college campuses, then Senate Bill 762 is the first step that's going to really allow survivors the ability to come forward without fear. So there's still a lot of work to be done, obviously, with conversations, changing those conversations about sexual assault and survivors. But Senate Bill 762 begins to point us in the right direction, and that's why I'm here to advocate it for it today. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Person Langer, please.
I just want to thank the two student speakers. I think that shows a lot of courage, but also it's really great leadership for people who unfortunately have had that experience. So thank you for having the guts and the poise and the sense that you shouldn't have to tolerate that to come forward and help us consider an important bill. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. you didn't ask for it, and it wasn't your fault.
And I would just say, I hope you'll help your younger sisters, so to speak, coming up through, so the freshmen understand that people can't get away with that, and that it's good to report it, and you'll help them get through that in the future. It's gone on way, way too long. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Mary Sill.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And you heard from the most important people in the room already. All I wanted to do was add that Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is in support of this policy. We think it absolutely makes sense for there to be immunity for victims of sexual assault when a police investigation is ongoing. And so we support that, and we just wanted to put that on the record for you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 7628 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 7628 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 7628 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Yeah. I'll take it.
Representative Olson will be the carrier. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 252. Senator Taylor, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 252 allows certain people with a suspended license to receive a hardship permit or to go to gambling addiction treatment programs. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
Thank you. And Mary, you can come up again, too, if you want. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Chair Barker. And before I proceed, thank you so much for passing the last bill. I'm a little choked up. Amazing women here. So let's talk about something else now. For the record, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21, and here to request your support for Senate Bill 252. While the state benefits from funds generated by the Oregon Lottery, it is important to acknowledge that some Oregonians suffer from gambling addiction. Senate Bill 252 aims to reduce barriers for individuals seeking treatment to address gambling addiction and limit any negative impacts of gambling and the Oregon Lottery. Currently in Oregon, someone can be issued a hardship permit to operate a motor vehicle in order to drive for specific purposes, for example, to travel to and from drug and alcohol addiction programs or to seek employment or to get a job if there is no other reasonable transportation option available. Senate Bill 252 adds that a hardship permit may be issued for seeking treatment for gambling addiction. This bill comes out of the Senate without opposition. I brought this bill forward in coordination with Director Barry Pack at the Oregon Lottery and their legal counsel. He's going to speak about the bill as well. And I want to thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the committee for hearing this bill today. And I urge your support for Senate Bill 252.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Barry Pack, Director of the Oregon Lottery. And I just wanted to share a couple of quick points. I think Senator Taylor's covered the basics of the bill. Oregon Lottery's mission is to maximize profits for the people of Oregon commensurate with the public good. And one of the ways that we define that public good is limiting the harmful effects of our games to Oregonians, which is why, in part, the legislature has chosen to dedicate funding from lottery revenues for treatment. So treatment is free and confidential to any Oregonian who needs it. I wanted to share a story about the genesis of this bill and what's happened since it's been moving through the legislature. Shortly after I joined the lottery last year, I went to Bridgeway Recovery Services, which is the only residential treatment program for gambling addiction west of the Mississippi. It's here in Salem, and it's an excellent program. I went out and toured the house and then met with the patients who were currently in residence. As in a big group meeting. It was a very emotional experience for everyone involved, I think, but it was a fantastic experience for me to hear the stories of people who are struggling with gambling addiction. One of the gentlemen there shared a story about his past. He was in residential treatment because his prior attempt at recovery failed and he relapsed. When he was in his first recovery, he was reaching out to his counselor about how to handle it, and the advice was just go to meetings. Schedule as many meetings as you can in a day that will keep you on the wagon, so to speak. Because of where he lived and because of a prior drug and alcohol problem, his license was suspended, And the only way he could get to a gambling addiction meeting was by bus, but he was in such a remote location that it would take about an hour and a half to get there and then back again. So he couldn't surround himself with meetings and the kind of support that he needed. He told me this story and about how his relapse then continued to degrade his life. And he mentioned that he could get a hardship permit for drug and alcohol treatment, but not for gambling addiction treatment. And I thought to myself, well, why on earth would we not offer this for gambling addiction? So I approached Senator Taylor and asked her to introduce this bill and bring it for you today. What I also want to share is I've been keeping the Lottery Commission up to date about the progress of this bill. And some of the advocates in the recovery community who attend our meetings came up to testify and said that he went back to Bridgeway Recovery and saw the same gentleman who's still successfully in recovery and told him about the bill and that the House had passed it. And he burst into tears. He was so moved at the fact that someone had listened and was taking action. And I think mostly he felt heartened that someone else in his position might have options with this bill. So I urge your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name for the record is Mary Sell. I'm with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We approach this bill from a good policy standpoint, but also from kind of a barrier removal standpoint. And so thank you so much for bringing this bill. We absolutely do support it. We think that it kind of goes hand in hand with a lot of the legislation that's been before you and before the Senate this session, all about removing collateral consequences or at least lessening the burden of the collateral consequence and allowing people to get to treatment when they need to get to it. The practitioners in Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association represents people who have all sorts of backgrounds and apps. I've personally represented people who have gambling addiction, and a lot of times it does go hand in hand with substance abuse, but those treatments are generally separate. And so it does absolutely make sense for this to be added, and we appreciate the sponsors for bringing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further, any questions? Okay, thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on the Senate Bill 252 and open a work session.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 252 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 252 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Stark, be our curator, please. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 327.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 327 extends recreational immunity to employees, agents, and volunteers of landowners when acting within the scope of their employment. There are no amendments. There is an indeterminate fiscal impact and a minimal revenue impact.
Okay. Ian Caldwell, Rob Bovet, and Rocky Dollum.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel Association of Oregon Counties, here today representing a very broad coalition of landowners. We have a one-pager on OLIS. If you're interested on the backside, you can see how broad this coalition is in strong support of this bill that comes to you from the Senate 30-0. Here's the real short story, and I'll keep this brief. I know your time is running. So Oregon, as we can see from today, is just full of recreational opportunities all around Oregon for not only Oregonians but for visitors as well. And the reason most of Oregon is open for these recreational opportunities is because decades ago a bargain got struck. And the bargain basically is pretty simple. If landowners, public or private, opened their lands for recreational opportunities for free to the public, then they are granted immunity from any liability that might arise from those visitors on that land. And that's all fine and dandy and was working really well until the Oregon Supreme Court ruled in a case not long ago called the Johnson case that the way the statute is written technically covered the landowner but not the agents and employees of the landowner, thus virtually eviscerating the statute. opening up pretty significant liability. The result of that new liability has been increased insurance rates, park closures, closures of land. And unless we fix this fairly quickly, we're going to see this continue to roll throughout Oregon with a whole lot more closures. So what Senate Bill 327 does is it just restores the bargain that got struck decades ago and adds agents and employees to the recreational immunity statute. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but I'll turn it over to my colleague to the left here.
Rocky, go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Rocky Dahlem. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, but also carrying a message on behalf of all of the agricultural and forest land owners in the state, including OFIC, Oregon Farm Bureau, and the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Again, Rob pointed to the letter on OLIS, but as far as the private land perspective, he captured really the history of this issue and the fix that we're supporting in 327A. Oregon has a longstanding tradition on both public lands and private lands of recreation, and it's key to our economy and sort of the fabric of who we are as Oregonians. And oftentimes that includes access to private lands. In this tradition, private landowners bear some cost outside of the liability with recreation. That includes cleanup and maintenance and roads and access. People come to our members and our affiliate members' lands to hunt, fish, bike, watch birds, and other forms of recreation. Other than a few minor exceptions in the statute for wood cutting and gardening, the immunity only applies if you open your lands for free. Some landowners, as you know, elect to charge a fee for people to come and access their lands. Nowadays, many entities hold their, or many families hold their lands in some type of entity, which means while the LLC or the partnership that has the entity may enjoy the current immunity, the actual people who stand behind those entities and oftentimes are really where the assets are don't get the same immunity without the fix here in 327A. We could talk a little bit more if you'd like about the how we got here. I think Rob covered it adequately, but we would ask that you support it as well so that we can move forward. The Johnson decision that really had forced some of this discussion and the need for this statute isn't necessarily characterized as creating new causes of action. I think the effective public policy result is that it will limit and reduce recreational opportunities for Oregonians as private landowners make the tough decision to not let people onto their land for fear of the of liability. So we'd appreciate your support of 327. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ian Caldwell. I'm a resident of the city of Redmond, and I'm a volunteer. I have submitted written testimony, and in the last page of that, there's a couple photos of what I'm going to be talking about today. I am in strong support of Senate Bill 327. I am a rock climber. I've been climbing at Smith Rock since 1991, so over 25 years now. I do a lot of volunteer work out at Smith Rock. I do a lot of trail work and maintenance. I replace bolts, so climbers put bolts in the wall, and when those age over time, I repair them to put stainless steel so they'll last longer. I'm also a member of the search and rescue team, so I'm often one of the first people responding to injuries and accidents out of Smith Rock. A couple years ago, I embarked on a new volunteer project, kind of working with the city of Redmond. In 2007, the city constructed a bridge over the Dry Canyon. So the Dry Canyon is a 4-mile-long park that runs to kind of the length of Redmond. And this bridge is about an 800-foot span that goes over top of the Dry Canyon. And underneath that span, there's three different arches like this. They're shaped like this. So the start of the arch is a 45-degree angle, and the top of that is horizontal. When I first saw that as a climber, I was like, wow, that's the coolest thing. It'd be so cool to put climbing routes underneath that. I eventually approached the city and talked to them about it, and they were actually open to the concept. I spent about a year and a half working with city staff. We developed a 45-page management plan of how we would construct routes under the bridge, how we'd do fundraising, how we'd sign it, and addressing liability and all those issues. Some of the standards was we had to inspect the route up to four times a year, so a quarterly inspection of that, and also that we would, the insurance company wanted signs at the base of the route that would talk about the risks of climbing. So in July of 2015, I got full approval from the mayor, the city council, everybody to start working on the route, and we were covered under the city's insurance policy. So I spent my my summer vacation time out drilling holes in the bottom of this arch. When we constructed it, it was designed for experienced rock climbers. This is not a beginner's opportunity. You really had to know what you're doing. To go one step further, I actually created the start of the route as a filter. So I made really small handholds that you would need several years of climbing experience just to get off the ground and to be able to flip the first bolt. Well, in August, we had a big ribbon cutting. The mayor came out, me and him held scissors and cut the ribbon. We had about 100 people there. Everybody's really excited about it. The Chamber of Commerce, they were so excited. They actually put a photo of the bridge on the front cover of their visitor guide. And sadly, right after they did that, the bridge got closed. I got a phone call from city staff, and they said that because of this Portland lawsuit, that the insurance company no longer wanted to insure the bridge, and the city talked to them extensively about how safe it was and all the measures that we were taking, and they just didn't want to do it. They shopped around. The new insurance policy was going to cost $157,000 for 1 year. And there was no way that the city could afford that. The insurance company said, if you guys fix that law, if the law gets changed to cover employees and volunteers, then we'll cover the insurance, we'll cover the bridge again. So this Senate Bill 327 will fix that problem. But it's more than just this bridge. This is other rock climbing areas all throughout Oregon. It's on federal land, on state land, on private property, and those other rock climbing areas are bound to get closed if this does not get fixed. And this also goes for hiking and mountain biking and just lots of outdoor activities. So again, with that, I am in support of Senate Bill 327.
Hey, thank you. Are there any questions of this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. Art Tower.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Arthur Towers. I'm with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Senate Bill 327 is the product of a work group of which we were a part, and we really appreciated the opportunity to participate with in the group led by Senator Prezansky. We were hopeful that in that work group that there would be broad agreement among stakeholders, but unfortunately there's only a narrow agreement. Senate Bill 327A accurately reflects that narrow agreement, and we support the bill. We said we would support the bill, even though it doesn't address all the issues, and we do support the legislation. However, compromises by definition don't satisfy all the parties every time, and we do think that in the future there are a number of issues in this area that should be resolved, that the committee should consider. As was stated previously, current law states that, I want to narrow the focus a little bit. We're much more concerned about the public sector responsibility as opposed to the private sector. So current law states the government has immunity from responsibility for injuries and damages on its property if the victim was engaged in recreational activity. Two exceptions, if they charged an admission or user fee, or if the negligence was caused by an individually identifiable government employee. Now, we all agree, and what the Senate bill does is it eliminates that second exemption. suing the individual employee doesn't make a lot of sense. I know there are a lot of really good people who have worked in city parks who've just gone out and done their job, and they aren't necessarily the ones that need to be sued. But again, that was the only avenue available in many instances. So the question is, what's the impact on a family that suffers an injury if there's an improperly maintained playground or an improperly marked swimming hole? First of all, the family is not allowed to make its case in court. The family has to pay the medical bills from the first dollar, regardless of whose responsibility the injury was. Their private insurance or the Oregon Health Plan could pay it too. The family is not eligible for any compensation for economic or non-economic damages or any other type of loss. And there's no opportunity for the family to hold the government accountable or gain a sense of closure or vindication via litigation, even if it was the government's fault that they didn't properly maintain the facility that they are advertising for recreation. So let me walk you through one example just to give you a sense of how this works. So in 2012, a family of eight was swimming at a swimming hole in Washington County out at Hague Lake in a county park. One person stepped off a steep underwater cliff, and the drop-off wasn't visible from the surface. The bottom of the lake was slippery mud, and the currents in that spot are strong. Several other family members went in to rescue the first, and the four of them were in real danger. Fortunately, another family there, like unbelievably, were former lifeguards and an EMT, and they were able to resuscitate these four people that nearly drowned. So after that 2012 near-fatal incident, the county took no remedial action to warn people about the dangerous location. A Boy Scout came out on his scouting project and put up a kiosk with some life jackets. But the kiosk was in an out-of-the-way place, and there is no explanation why life jackets were needed. So if you take your kids out and they're waiting in the lake, you aren't going to wear a life jacket for waiting necessarily. But the other thing the county did do after the 2012 incident is they renamed the $55 annual user fee as a parking fee. Okay, and that's a big difference because, as we talked about earlier, the government has the responsibility, has the liability if it's a user fee, but if it's a parking fee, they're only responsible if you drown in the parking lot. So county officials testified under oath that the fee has created a surplus of tens of thousands of dollars. They also testified that putting up warning signs listing the unique danger of the site, building kiosks with life jackets where they can be seen, stenciling warnings on the sidewalk would cost hundreds of dollars. Further, the government has discretionary immunity, which means that the government could create a safety policy and follow it. And just by doing that, just about regardless of what the safety policy is, then they're insulated from liability. So in 2014, at the very same spot, 3-year-old Jeremy Scholl and his grandmother, his mother, and his mother's brother all drowned at that same exact location. The Garcia family brought suit against the county for not having the place properly marked. So again, the same spot where an incident occurred just 2 years previous. And the judge threw the suit out here in the last week or so because the fee was for parking, not for using the park. Recreational discretionary immunity are not the only remedy or protections the government has in cases like this. The government also has damage caps under the Tort Claims Act. So the cap for damages for a local government in a single injury or death is $691,000. So what could the government do? The claim is that they have to, without the recreational immunity, they have to close the parks. And from my sense of things, the government could fight back against the insurance industry. Secondly, the government could raise money to make facilities safer. And we're seeing that happen right now in Portland. They're passing working on a $700 million bond measure about school safety because they have lead in their pipes. Now, drinking drinking contaminated water isn't a recreational activity, so they don't have immunity there. So they're going out and trying to pass a bond measure to make schools safer, and that's a good thing, but they should consider it for playground safety as well. The government can also allocate existing funds, and we have a couple examples of that. After Jeremy and his family died drowning in the park, the county did spend the nominal amount of money to put up warning signs listing the unique danger of the site. They did build the kiosks with life jackets where they can be seen. They did sense the warnings on the sidewalk. And they did spend the money, albeit it didn't take very much money, but they did spend the money, but tragically after the death of the four family members. A second approach along the same lines is Senate Bill 1062. That's a bill filed here recently. There's a hearing tomorrow afternoon. It has bipartisan, bicameral support and allocates $2.5 million for state grants to school districts to detect carbon monoxide and test for lead in water. Another good bill that should pass. And again, playground safety should be on a more even footing with some of these other issues would be the expectation that we have. Or a local government should be responsible when their action leads to the injury of another. I'll stop there. I'll remind the committee, I'll remind myself that we support the bill. And these other issues are issues that we should consider down the road. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Gregg?
Thank you, Chair Barker. I know you and I have talked about this, and that's part of why you referenced a minute ago. In as plain of non-legalese English as you can give me, in a scenario that I'll tell you, can you tell me what protections this employee would have currently versus once this is passed? So as you mentioned, I used to, I've already told you, I used to work for the county parks in Josephine County. And every single morning, my job was to go out and check every single piece of equipment, make sure the bolts were there, make sure everything was functioning. It was the first thing on our to-do list. So let's say I go out and someone starts talking to me and somehow I fail to check, a swing. And for whatever reason, the bolt had come loose that night and I failed to check it, but, not intentionally. And someone goes swinging, they break their leg. Now, as an employee, under current law, without this bill, what sort of protections do I have versus if this bill passes?
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, good question. So two things. Let's take the long shot that you are found responsible. My understanding is that the county is or your employer is responsible for indemnifying you. In other words, it's not you on the hook personally for the liability. However, in the case that you describe, it would strike me as a pretty difficult case for an injured person to make. The county had the responsibility for maintaining the swing set. It had a set plan. It followed the set plan day after day after day. There's a one-day lapse, and harm occurred. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I just work for him. But that's the. But so my sense of things is that 12 reasonable people, like up on the dais, would hear that case, and I think they would say, the county took its responsibility seriously, and accidents happen, and accidents do happen. I mean, I'm not proud of this, but I was out at a playground Saturday with my granddaughters, and I was coerced into going down the kiddie slide. And if I'd gotten hurt doing that, that was on me. But if my granddaughter had gotten hurt and had suffered a permanent injury of some sort, I would really want to hold those folks accountable for not maintaining their swing set.
Thank you, Mr. Tower. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 327A. And we're not going to work it today, but we're hanging on to it for a while. It is still very much alive. Any further business? Thank you, committee. We stand adjourned. Any further business? Thank you, committee. We stand adjourned.